From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, an update on news and events from around Latin America and the Caribbean with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, reporting from Managua, Nicaragua. Okay, so let's start in Peru.
Okay, Don, yeah, if you look at the what's happening in the region in from a broad perspective, it's easy to kind of be kind of taken in or seduced or whatever term you want to use by the mainstream corporate media about, you know, there are direct things that are happening kind of immediately in this period. But, and I think it's important that make it look as though the right wing is very much in the ascendant. But if you take a step back and look at it from a broader point of view, and the fundamental reality hasn't changed that we've been discussing for well over a year now, really ever since the two disastrous election results back in 2015, when Mauricio Macri won the presidency in Argentina, mm-hmm. and the Venezuelan opposition did exceptionally well, largely as a result of abstention by the Chavista vote in Venezuela,
right.
To secure a dominant majority in Venezuela's legislature. But ever since then, if you look at what's been happening, the right wing haven't been able to capitalize on the massive advantage that they got at that time. And the fundamental reason for that is that their policy agenda is extremely weak, and they're trying to impose policies across the region that we know don't work.
Right.
And the popular response to that has been massive rejection. And that's true even in a very conservative country like Peru. So if you look at Peru, and we haven't talked about Peru for a very long time, but just briefly, because there's so much else to talk about. And what's happening in Peru is that Kuczynski, the president who won very, very narrowly against another right-wing candidate, Keiko Fujimori, the daughter of the dictator Fujimori, who basically destroyed Peru's institutions all through the 90s. And he won by a narrow margin against Keiko Fujimori. But to begin with, his policies were extremely popular because, like all these right-wing leaders that have come to power, they've said, well, with our right-wing agenda, we're going to bring prosperity to the peoples of the region.
Right.
And hopelessly untrue, ridiculously untrue. You know, and there's not a chance that their policies are going to work when they're the very same policies that were massively rejected by the region's impoverished majority in election after election.
Because they didn't work.
Really,
because they
really,
didn't work. Yeah, right.
Sorry, Don.
Because they weren't working, right.
Because they weren't working, exactly.
Right.
So now these right-wing governments, they've got back into power by hook or by crook, sometimes legitimately like Mauricio Macri, and sometimes completely illegitimately like Julius Temer in Brazil,
right.
For example.
By crook.
Kuczynski won the election in a country that, for a very long time, has had a kind of center-right majority among the population.
Right.
And his initial approval ratings were really good, but now they're dropping like a stone. And the reason is because he, like Macri, like Temer, like all these right-wing leaders, like Santos in Colombia, they haven't been able to deliver on their promises of prosperity. So the one of the big things that's happening in Peru is that there's currently a teacher strike, and that's tremendously important because, despite attempts to resolve the demands of the striking teachers, who are now being joined by health workers, the consensus among the rank and file in the labor unions in those sectors is that the government hasn't offered enough and what they have offered has been offered in such a way that they don't feel they have sufficient guarantees to be able to say, right, it's all resolved, we can call off the strike. So that public sector strike is kind of emblematic of the overall conflict in the region between a right-wing agenda that still goes for neoliberal structural adjustment type measures, austerity, cut back in the public sector, and that is very, very, very important. And if the public sector in Peru can manage to defend their rights, and that'll be a very important positive result for progressive forces in the region. And then in Peru, you also have the theme of corruption that is very much to the fore in public life, and one that Kupczynski was able to play, and in large part, it enabled him to defeat Keiko Fujimori back in the election, whenever it was, a couple of years ago now, 18 months ago, whenever it was, because Fujimori, of course, is very much associated with the corruption and repression of her father. Yeah, and right. Kupczynski was able to distance himself from that.
Right.
Part of what's going on in Peru at the moment is that the former president, Humala, and his wife, who were caught up in corruption scandal, mainly around how their election campaigns were financed, and that involves the regional scandal involving the huge Brazilian engineering multinational Odebrecht. Now that scandal is touched Peru. It's also playing a part in what's going on in Ecuador at the moment. It turns out that Mauricio Macri, back in 1998, initiated what was a strategic partnership from the point of view of his businesses with Odebrecht. So apart from the Panama Papers scandal, in which Mauricio Macri and his family are deeply implicated, he's now also being touched by the Odebrecht scandal. So it remains to see how that's going to unfold in Argentina. In Ecuador, what's happening is that there's the beginnings of what looks like a very damaging division, and perhaps not even the beginnings. It's advanced quite a way now, to the point where Lenin Moreno, the successful presidential candidate this year's elections, has separated Jorge Glass, his vice presidential the candidate who, when they won, he's now become the vice president. But Lenin Moreno has separated Jorge Glass from his official responsibilities because they have an ideological difference provoked by Lenin Moreno's really extraordinary attacks on Rafael Correa, the previous president. There's a deep disagreement within the Alianza País party, which is the party of Glass and Moreno, about how to deal with the economic situation and other issues to do with national unity and stuff like that. Now, Lenin Moreno is saying, well, we have to reach out to the right wing. But most people would agree with that in some sense, but how do you do that? And what Lenin Moreno has done, apparently, this is what's been alleged, is that he's privatized one of the national electric companies. I'm not sure if it's the distribution company or the generating company, to former president Bucaram, who was one of the most corrupt presidents in Ecuador's recent history. So the Glass and Correa and their current inside Alianza País are resisting that. They're resisting this, what they regard as a step back into the bad old days of you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours corruption. And another aspect of disagreement in Ecuador over Lenin Moreno's policies is that today, for example, it was reported in, I think, in Telesur and elsewhere, that he's introduced a moderate package, but still a package of austerity measures. And that is very much against the economic planning of Rafael Correa's team, which is the same team that Moreno has at the moment. He seems to have overridden their advice.
Right.
So there's that. Well, that's very much in response to right-wing demands. And also he's engaged in a rapprochement with the most extreme elements of the indigenous peoples' organizations, who are such vicious opponents of Rafael Correa. So that how that is going to pan out over the next while is very important. In regional terms, that's important at a national policy level for Ecuador, but it doesn't affect Ecuador's stance in support of Venezuela. And it's also indicative of the way the progressive forces in the region, in some countries, are still finding it hard to regroup. For example, because that division reflects policy disagreements about how to engage with the right wing, how to engage with the grassroots of the respective progressive movement's base, which was one of the fundamental problems in Venezuela, which we'll get to in a minute, I hope. And you can see that kind of disarray, the ideological disarray, also in Uruguay.
Yeah, I mean, look, not for nothing. This is an ideological problem that goes back at least to Lenin and the NEP, really. How do you engage? And this is something that was, in a way, the genius of Chavez and Fidel Castro, I guess, because that's where a lot of the inspiration came from, and also of China. You've had all these different ways that the socialist forces have had to deal with, essentially conditions that do not yet allow actual socialist relations across the economy, because the economy is not yet fully developed and expressed. There is a right wing, depending on which context you're talking about, which time and place, has a certain amount of power, perhaps control of the state, perhaps control of just the military, who knows what, depending on where you are. And you have to engage with them in different ways while you're watching them try to eat you from inside. And this is a problem that, that the left governments have had to wrestle with since the first left government, maybe the first Soviet government, with the NEP again.
Right. So, and in Uruguay, the way that's been expressed has been at the highest level in their foreign affairs policy. They until now, they've been defending Venezuela,
right?
In a kind of now you see me, now you don't kind of way, because they're under such tremendous pressure from their immediate neighbors, in particular Argentina and Brazil, who have tremendous economic leverage and commercial leverage over Uruguay, which is a tiny country of just a few million people.
Right.
So then before we go on, get back to that, because that'll take us straight into talking about Venezuela. And it's also worth looking at this trend of the kind of tug of war between the ideological tug of war between failed right wing policies and attempts by the left wing to regroup. And in Argentina, it looks as though Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner is going to do very well in the primary elections for the legislature, which take place next Sunday the 13th.
Right.
And these primaries are meant to filter out candidates that don't stand a chance of doing well in the legislative elections. And it looks as though Cristina is going to come out on top of those elections, which I can't remember if they're in October or early November, at that time of year. And those are important elections because they're a kind of artificial referendum on the policies, in particular the domestic policies of Mauricio Macri. Now, that's taking place in the context of deepening economic crisis in Argentina. Things are not getting better in Argentina in terms of employment, in terms of poverty. Everything seems to be going downhill,
right,
which is the exact opposite of what Macri promised when he took office. And at the same time, and the extent to which that economic repression is being accompanied by repression of civil and political rights, which we see right. most clearly in the imprisonment of Milagros Sala, the indigenous and labor union activist who's been in jail on spurious charges for like almost 2 years now, unless I'm misremembering.
And you also, not for nothing, they went after Cristina Fernandez also. They tried to tag her too.
Yeah, using the corruption motif, which has been a dismal failure. But that, right. you know, they can always find something to resurrect that, because they've got enough ideologically right wing leaning judges in Argentina. They kind of fall out of the wardrobe when you open the door. But the crucial thing immediately that's a human rights concern in Argentina in regard to civil and political rights is the disappearance. Now, that's tremendously significant, the disappearance of a young Mapuche indigenous people's activist. And I can't remember his name, but a young guy who was on a demonstration trying to defend the Mapuche are an indigenous group in both Argentina and Chile, and in both countries they've tended to suffer repression more in Chile, but also to some extent in Argentina. Now, the fact that this young guy has disappeared in Argentina, that is tremendously significant.
Yeah.
And we just have to hope that nothing bad has happened to him and that he does turn up alive. But that is going to impact a great deal in the developing political process as Argentina heads towards its legislative elections at the end of the year.
Yeah, it's October 22nd is the date, by the way. Okay. And what's interesting, I'm looking at some of the reporting on this, going back to the beginning of the year. And you have Forbes in March. Argentina's midterm elections. Will Macri's pro-business reforms, and then it's chopped off, but it's basically, you know, stand up. Will they succeed? Then it shows, July, Bloomberg. Argentina's midterms should worry Mauricio Macri. U.S. News .com at July 2nd. Poll shows Fernandez block tied in elections. And then in July, Bloomberg saying Argentina losing luster is debt, blah, blah, blah. And then you got The Guardian calling Queen Cristina with her senator.
Oh, yeah.
But they're all saying that apparently the fortunes of her, that party, of her party, are rising. And Mauricio Macri is more or less drowning in the failure of his economic policies, or lack of economic policies.
Yeah, and it's not as clear cut as that, because there are complicating factors by third parties.
Right, of course.
And there's this guy Massa, who essentially divided the vote, the anti-Macri vote. He played a typical social democrat role, dividing the progressive
right.
vote, so
right,
that
right.
the right wing got in. Yep. But then let's see how that pans out. I hope we'll be able to talk about that next week after the elections on the 13th. Then, but in Brazil, a very significant development has been that the Brazilian Congress was looking at whether or not to prosecute Temer on yet another corruption charge, and they decided not to.
Right.
And he then immediately said that he would proceed with his legislative program attacking pension rights for retired people in Brazil.
Mm-mm-mm.
So, how to interpret that? And at the same time, Lula da Silva's popularity seems to be increasing,
yeah.
If anything, in the process that will end in the 2018 presidential elections, and I think they're held in July next year. But my interpretation of that is that, and the Senate, if they wanted to get rid of Temer, if the right wing had decided, as many observers thought that they would, to dump Temer, that decision in the Brazilian National Congress made clear that they decided not to. And what they're doing is they're doubling down on their right wing legislative agenda, so as to put in place a set of measures that any future government under progressive government under Lula da Silva will then have to try and address. So, and that's But that's all of that seems to me, what's happening in Brazil, what's happening in Argentina, what's happening in Peru, seems to me to be on balance a sign that the right wing can't get it together because they have no valid, viable policies. And what's happening in Ecuador, in Venezuela, in particular, is that, and to some extent also in Argentina, is that the progressive forces are trying to find their feet, and they're at different stages in that process. In Venezuela, they're much further along the road to finding a viable way to defeat the right-wing attacks. In Ecuador, they're probably just beginning. In Argentina, they're probably halfway along that road. But let's start talking about Venezuela if we've got time.
Yeah, we do.
What happened last week was it's tremendously important for the region that the progressive government in Venezuela is able to maintain its popular support, and things look quite positive at the moment in that regard.
Yeah.
Because over 8 million people voted for the establishment of the Constituent Assembly, which was a tremendous victory for the ruling party, and in particular a personal triumph for Nicolas Maduro and his team. The right wing response to that has been to focus on their international to mobilize their international support to try and put together some kind of policy response that will negate the tremendous popular support that the government very clearly has.
Right.
Now, in that context, immediately prior to that vote, just about a week prior to that vote, unless I'm misremembering, there was a vote in Mercosur that was attempted to expel or suspend Venezuela from Mercosur.
Yeah, to suspend.
And it was Uruguay and Bolivia's vote in that particular meeting that defeated that initiative. But then what Brazil and Argentina, the right wing in Paraguay, the right wing governments there did was they convened a meeting with a slightly different format, excluding Bolivia, and they put huge economic pressure on Uruguay. So in this latest meeting, called after the Constituent Assembly vote last Sunday, or not last Sunday, the Sunday before, they managed to, in a completely irregular and in fact illegal way, they formally suspended Venezuela from Mercosur on the basis that, the spurious basis that they claim that Venezuela hasn't complied with what are called the Ushuaia protocols. Now, the Ushuaia protocols are a couple of legal protocols that have to do with the institutional integrity of Mercosur, and they date back from, I think, the mid-90s. But the extraordinary thing about that, and the hypocritical, cynical thing about that decision, is that none of the Mercosur countries have completely complied with the Ushuaia protocols. In fact, which call for the legislation in regard to Mercosur to be incorporated into national legislation.
Yeah.
And only Venezuela is the only country that's of the four countries in Mercosur that has complied. It certainly complied more than the others with that institutional rule. And all that. So in that sense, the decision to suspend Mercosur is completely spurious, but also it's dishonest because they should have invited Venezuela to take part in the meeting,
right?
Because Venezuela is a full member of Mercosur.
Right.
They did
right.
so formally, but when Venezuela said that it would certainly take part in the meeting, they ignored Venezuela's response
right.
and went ahead with the meeting without Venezuela, which makes it completely illegal.
Right.
But anyway, that's what you'd expect from these right-wing, these cynical right-wing operators.
Well, Vasquez, the Uruguay's president, his own party has been, very critical. The broad front. They reject the decision, basically, for Uruguay to chime in on the side of Argentina, Brazil, and Paraguay. And what's interesting also, you have this whole preoccupation with the institutional structures in these different countries. Venezuela's referendum is provided for under the constitution of that country, but you have in Brazil and Paraguay, two of the three, you essentially have the heirs of soft coups in power. Well, you know, one is the actual party in Temer, but in Paraguay also they had a soft coup back, you know, during Obama's time, and they've never really fixed that. So but they're sanctioning Venezuela for that kind of a problem.
Yeah, and that's all part of the overall cynicism and hypocrisy of the policy. But the important thing, looking at it from a regional point of view, why do I think that President Nicolas Maduro and his colleagues have made tremendous progress more than other places, more than progressive governments and political movements in other countries in the region? Because they've re-engaged with their base. And that is going to give them tremendous energy and inspiration and impetus going into the regional elections that are scheduled for December. Right. An interesting thing there is that the whole process of the Constituent Assembly has thrown Venezuela's right wing into deep disarray.
Right.
And prior to the assembly, it looked as though they were going to maintain a reasonably united front and try and move forward with the extra parliamentary attempts to overthrow the legitimate government of Venezuela under President Nicolas Maduro.
Right.
But after the Constituent Assembly, one of the planks that they were united on prior to the Constituent Assembly is that they probably wouldn't participate in the regional election scheduled for December, because they were going to try and argue that all Venezuela's existing institutions are illegitimate. But following that Constituent Assembly vote, which inside Venezuela, everybody recognizes that gave a huge legitimacy to, overwhelming legitimacy to Nicolas Maduro's government.
Right,
and whatever the corporate media say, and whatever the European Union or the United States government or President Juan Manuel Santos says in Colombia, inside Venezuela, nobody believes that the right wing have any legitimacy in terms of their claims to majority support. They don't, and the government does.
Right.
So that has really changed the state of play on the ground, and it's forced the sections of the opposition coalition, the MUD coalition, to agree to take part. In particular, Acción Democrática of Ramón Alup, the historic leader of that wing of Venezuela's political spectrum. He and his colleagues have decided to take part in the regional elections in Venezuela, and that's a huge defeat. It's a sign of a deep split inside Venezuela's opposition.
And we're going to have to pick it up there next week and explain, you know, go into some more detail because essentially they have to rethink their entire game plan. Their timeline is all screwed up again, and that is the result of the 8 million people voting. And despite what they tell us here and around the world, the people inside Venezuela saw them go to the polls, and they know that it's true. So,
on Telesur, there are interviews with some labor union workers from New York who participate as observers in the Constituent Assembly elections, and those are well worth listening to understand what's really going on in Venezuela.
So we'll do that. And Tony, thank you very much. We'll speak with you again next week and get an update on this.
Okay, thanks a million, John. Talk to you soon.
Yep. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.